This is the first debate session on anarchism. This topic of this one is anarchism and nationalism. And this will go till 2:30, so we've got a good long chunk of time. And I'm going to let the folks who are sitting here introduce themselves personally and give their own background. But just so you know who we're talking about, my name's Peter. I live in Wisconsin. I'm going to be one of the moderators and respondents today. We also have Cindy, who right now is in Chicago, although very soon she'll be from Vermont. She's going to be the other moderator and respondent. We've got Ashanti, who's visiting from Brooklyn, and then Mike at the end of the table, and he's from Chicago, too. And that's the basic setup. Now, one really important change that we had, I'm not sure if it changed, but originally the organizers of Matches and Mayhem, and this is sponsored by Arsenal, is that right, too? And Arsenal, had thought of this as kind of a classic debate for folks who were at last year's Matches and Mayhem. We had sort of two people on one side, two people on the side, putting forth opposite positions, and then the audience got to argue through them after that. And this year, when we sat down and talked about stuff beforehand, we kind of gradually realized that our areas of agreement and disagreement around the question of anarchism and nationalism don't really fall into categories that could constitute a real-life point-counterpoint debate. So we thought instead we'd have more of a round table. And the main presenters are going to be Ashanti and Mike. They're each going to have about 10 minutes each after I do my quick introduction. And then Cindy and I are going to ask sort of pointed questions of the two of them, and they're going to have a little sort of 5-minute chance to respond to those, and then we're going to open it up to everybody. Does that all sound cool? That's a good format? Excellent. So, the reason that a lot of us are here, I think, the reason I'm here, is that anarchists, in a lot of ways, are confused about nationalism. And I'm certain that the Matches and Mayhem organizers asked me to moderate the panel, because I am more confused about nationalism than any other that I know. So you're not going to hear a lot of, you know, clear statements from me so far. Maybe later. Maybe you'll convince me of a good, strong position on this. And I thought of a nice metaphor when I live up in this little, in kind of a small city in Wisconsin. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. And I thought of this metaphor while I was driving to Pleasant Park here yesterday about the intersections between anarchism and nationalism. A lot of times when I drive in Madison, you got your North South streets, you got your east-west streets, and then meet, and there's a really simple intersection. You got maybe two or three cars coming from each direction, and there's no problem, the light turns green, and you just go. But in Chicago, you run into these Milwaukee, Damon, and North all coming together. They each got four lanes. There's a bus turning that way and a truck turning that way, and you got three cabs behind you honking because you don't know what the fuck you're doing. I don't even know what street is the same street that I was on 5 minutes ago. And to my mind, that reminded me of how complicated the intersections between anarchist politics and revolutionary nationalist politics are. A lot of the times, it seems like we're going the same direction. Sometimes it seems like we're about to turn and crash into each other, and it gets very complicated and confusing very, very fast. And I think that's not just because we're confused people, or I'm a confused person. I think it's because the issues are genuinely really, really complicated, partly because nationalism is kind of too simple a term. There are so many different varieties of national identity kinds of politics. Sometimes they're really exclusive, they shut a lot of other people out. Sometimes they're inclusive, they gather more people in. Sometimes they can be emancipatory and revolutionary and anti-statist. Sometimes they can be very, very strictly statist and authoritarian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't want to just say that it's complex because nationalism is a complicated phenomenon. I also think it's complex because anarchism itself is such a widely differentiated movement. There's so many different varieties of anarchism. Some of them sort of, sometimes, I fall into this myself, we think, okay, we're anarchists, we know we're against hierarchy, we know we're against authority, we know we're against domination, and that's cool, and that's all we need to say, and we're not always as good as we could be at really wrestling with really particular, concrete, specific forms of those phenomena, a lot of which, in the U.S. at least, have to do with what you might call ethnic identity or national identity. So that's one big reason we're here today. Another thing that I want to mention before we hand the floor off to our two main presenters, I happened to be reading this essay yesterday from maybe 6 years ago by a guy named Adolf Reed. I don't know if folks know him. He's been here in Chicago. And the essay is called The Curse of Community. And he puts the word community in quote marks because he's, well, one of the things he complains about in the essay is that he's really sick of people appealing to the community that they're a part of. And one of the things he talks about in the essay is what he calls the rhetoric of authenticity that often comes with a kind of national identity or community-based politics. And I want to see if we can both question the kind of rhetoric of authenticity that often comes with that kind of politics, but also question the rhetoric of anarchist authenticity that I think sometimes comes up when this debate gets played out in our scene. So I'm going to shut up there, and we're going to hand the floor over to Ashanti for stuff. Okay.
I like what you said. I'm willing to go with the discussion after that. That was good. I'm out of Brooklyn. My background is Black Panther Party, and that was my, my nationalism also comes out of the Black Panther Party. But before that, I just considered myself a Black nationalist, and out of the Black Power movement, and that mainly focused on, Black people coming together and having political power over our destiny. It wasn't necessarily a vision of a state. It was more of a vision of controlling our community. When I got into the Black Panther Party, then I was open up to more ideological influences, Marxism, Leninism, the influence of the national liberation movements in Asia, Africa, Latin America. Those also broadened my understanding of nationalism. The Black Panther Party considered itself revolutionary nationalists. And to separate itself from Black nationalists, which tended to be not so much just community-oriented, but it wasn't really a strong criticism towards capitalism. At least some brands of Black nationalists were sort of like just a Black capitalist vision. But socialism was very strong. My experiences from that, after going, I went underground, did the prison thing, but the prison thing allowed me to read. It allowed me to read a lot of stuff. And it was in prison that I was had a chance to kind of look back on my experience in the movement. But I had a chance to look at my experience through different lenses. And some of it was from radical psychology, coming from people from the Frankfurt School, Eric Fromm, who's some of them, other one? Marcuse, yeah, all of them, so it allowed me to just deepen my understanding. Feminism also allowed me to deepen my understanding of not only just national struggle, but just revolutionary struggle in the United States, period. Eventually I started reading anarchist material as well, but even though at the time, I wasn't really buying the whole picture of anarchism. I just liked the fact that it made more incisive analysis than a lot of the Marxist-Leninist ones that I was reading. It was more focused on like hierarchy, authoritarian politics, and things like that. So it allowed me to see that my nationalism had positives and negatives, but I began to see the negatives more, but not so much that I was ready to reject my nationalism. One of the things I had began to understand about my nationalism was that there was different components to it. And people, like Black people, I think in particular, was more on those aspects of nationalism that gave us a sense of pride. This was the Black Power movement, and also gave us a sense of community to deal with a lot of the things we had to deal with in a racist society. But now my anti-authoritarian perspective allowed me to see that if you look at nationalist movements uncritically, or you try to fight a nationalist movement without looking at some of the baggage you carry, then you may well end up creating another state or other kinds of authoritarian bodies once you have removed your old oppressors. And I began to see that with a lot of the liberation movements in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And I had already been convinced that there was, I guess I'm going to say, no revolution in Soviet Union and no liberation movements that were really successful in Asia, Africa, and Latin America if you judge it in terms of did the people have power. And on that basis, I'd say no. But a lot of that was due to the fact that now I had some different lenses to look at these struggles. But the nationalist aspect in terms of the pride, in terms of the sense of community, remains. And it, for me, it still remains a very valid aspect of nationalism. And that if we just move on, like the experiences in Europe with nationalist struggles, and we base our rejection of national struggles because of what happened in different European countries, and we do the same thing here in the United States, then we are rejecting something that becomes very important for people of color who struggle and who have ways of bonding who have ways of creating community in the sense of pride that can carry them on from one step to another, and who can figure out on their own how to move from one step to another when the limitations of that step become obvious. Right now, there are a lot of anarchists of color who are just as critical as I am of nationalism, but are not so much that they're willing to move without it. And that's pretty much the position that I'm at. My little personal saying is that I want to move beyond nationalism, but not without it, because I recognize what nationalism means to our community. How it works on the ground level is very important in terms of our survival. The problem comes in this society where, and now that we're at a point where we can build relationships with different activists, primarily white activists, and for me it's very important that it happens with anarchists, is that people see what it means to us that we have that component of nationalism. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's always wedded to the nation state, you know, but you may want to look at it more in terms of what it means in the sense of community, because not all of us want a nation state. And even people who are not specifically focused on an ideology are trying to create communities all over the United States. And they don't necessarily want somebody telling them what to do. So my challenge is around looking at nationalism, not in the sense of that it has to come with a state, but there are some ways that it can happen without a state if we look at it in terms of community and not necessarily the old concept, the old definitions of nationalism. And I'll end it there.
Excellent. 3 minutes left.
Hey.
All right. Thank you, Ashanti. Next is going to be Mike.
Excuse me. My name is Mike, and I live here in Chicago. I work on Arsenal Magazine and tried to help put together Matches and Mayhem, but I've been really busy the last little while. I have, for 8 years now, worked in the Puerto Rican community here in Chicago, and in particular with a couple of organizations that came out of a revolutionary nationalist tradition in the Puerto Rican community. In particular, one that was directly connected with armed struggle. And a number of the people who helped found the high school that I worked at did up to 19 years in prison. A couple of them are still in prison for taking up guns against the U.S. government, basically. That's the background that I bring to these discussions. It happens that those organizations have become increasingly reformist and liberal and disappointing to me in a lot of different ways in the last several years. But that tradition is still very strong. The revolutionary nationalist tradition is still very present in those organizations. And it was my experience with that, and it's the sort of the difference between that and the anarchism that I brought with myself into that situation when I started working there 8 years ago, that has forced me to rethink a lot of the sort of standard anarchist assumptions that I've had historically about nationalism. And I wanted to sort of go through three separate topics a little bit on each today. And I want to begin each with a different quote, and hopefully they won't bore you. It's terrible enough. The first is the longest quote. This quote is from Harry Cleaver, who is an autonomous Marxist. He wrote a book called Reading Capital Politically, and the quote is not actually about nationalism at all, but I think it has some striking parallels to the way in which I and some other anarchists think about nationalism. He says, "The alternative to ideological critique, whether of the political economy or of the philosophical variety, is to begin from a strategic analysis of the pattern of development of working class power as the only possible ground for answering the question of how that power can be increased. Such an analysis requires starting from an examination of workers' actual struggles, their content, how they have developed, and where they are headed. By this I mean the struggles of the workers themselves, not of their official, in quotes, organizations, trade unions, parties, etc. The actions of these organizations may accurately express the struggles of the workers themselves, or they may not. They are often completely at odds with them. It is because of this that we must begin with the unmediated struggles themselves. Since the class is not monolithic, but is divided, capital rules by division, the examination of such struggles necessitates an analysis of the different sectors of the class and their interrelations, especially how the struggles of one sector are or are not circulating to other sectors. It is only through the circulation of struggles, in which those of various sectors of the class interlink to become complementary, that real unity against capital is achieved. And I think one thing that's a very impressive position on its own in its analysis of the way in which class works in our society, but I also think it parallels in a lot of ways the analysis that some anarchists tend to bring to a whole range of analysis of the bad things that exist and the good things that we, you know, struggle with against them, whether that be in terms of class or in terms of racism or, you know, other things that that anarchists traditionally concern ourselves with. And the great thing, I think, about anarchists traditionally is that we have really internalized that distinction between the official organizations and the actual human beings who are really struggling against capitalism and racism and other bad things we don't like. And we recognize that labor unions are not really anti-capitalist, most of them. And we recognize that, you know, organizations that present themselves as being representative of different aspects of human existence maybe are or maybe are not representative in the way that they claim to be. I think that a weak spot, unfortunately, in anarchist analysis has often been, in terms of nationalism, that people have internalized that analysis to the point where they say that national liberation organizations are not really representative of you know, of the aspirations of the people they claim to represent. But they don't go far enough in understanding that that doesn't mean the, getting too many in, sorry. The problem is that anarchists fail to recognize that the popular sentiment that backs up national liberation organizations is real. They think that because the national liberation organizations aren't real or aren't representative, that therefore the sentiment that backs them up in, you know, in broad-based sectors of the population is also not real. And I think that's false. I think that we should understand that the organizations themselves, as national liberation organizations, can distort and sometimes, you know, take the wrong approach to the interests of people that they work with in the communities that they come from, but that the interests of those communities are, you know, need to be dealt with by all of us in terms of a broader revolutionary, you know, approach to society. So, in this particular context, I think the main point I'm trying to make is that there are these national liberation organizations on the one hand, but there is also a national identity that different communities have and internalize on the other hand. And in having criticisms of the one, that is the national liberation organizations, we should understand that those criticisms are not necessarily going to be equivalent to the criticisms we might have of the national identities on the other side. Sorry, this is, I'm not feeling like I'm articulating myself fairly well. I think I'm going to make one last caveat and move on to the second perspective. And that last caveat is that the criticism of, the anarchist criticism, understanding that national liberation organizations do not necessarily represent the broader interests of community populations from which they come, we forget that sometimes they do. As Harry Cleaver pointed out, there are occasions where the official organizations do in fact accurately represent the interests of the population that they, you know, they come from. And one classic example of that is in recent history is in all through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, as the Indonesian government tried to crush the Timorese independence movement, were less in tune with the sentiment of the population of Timor. And that it may or may not have, you know, carried out the exact program that, you know, anarchists would like to have seen in Timor. There is now a transitional government in Timor that's going to essentially integrate itself into capitalism. But if you look at the simple interaction between the population of Timor and the organizations that struggle for the independence of Timor, there is a very strong overlap between those interests. So that does actually happen, and I think it's a problem of anarchists that they too often fail to fail to see those overlaps. I've used a lot of time.
You can have.
guess the other thing that I wanted to do today was to try and stake out a mildly anti-nationalist position for anarchists. As inconsistent as that may sound with what just came before, the goal of what I've just articulated is primarily to understand why, to give anarchists a better understanding of why nationalism is as popular as it sometimes can be. It was not intended, in my mind, to be, you know, an explanation why anarchists should support nationalism. So I want to articulate a mildly anti-nationalist position at this point. And the best way that I can think of to do that is to point out, I think Peter's example of the intersection between anarchism and nationalism is a really good metaphor. And the one way that I think of that intersection is that there's a continuum where on one end is sort of the community and your, you know, your tight-knit community, whether it's your family, your friends, your coworkers, and on the other end, the mass of global humanity. And anarchists traditionally attach ourselves to the mass of global humanity and have unfortunately given, I think, short shrift to the particularities of community, and nations and nationalism lie somewhere in between, but closer, I think, towards the particular, the community end. And the flip side of that difficulty is the nationalist side. What I see in my experience working with the Puerto Rican community is that the particular end, the devotion to community and to the nation, tends to trump and take priority over the mass of global humanity. And so there's this intersection where you have to try and find a balance, I think, between those two competing goals, because I think there are valid reasons for each of them. The problem that I see is that inside anarchism there is the risk of the mass of global humanity replicating the sort of thing that a lot of us have seen in anarchist organizations, that is this, there's a concept in radical feminism known as the tyranny of structurelessness, where informal hierarchies emerge because you fail to have a formalized process for dealing with those sorts of hierarchies. And I think that happens inside anarchism as well, because people will say that we defend the abstract mass of humanity, but what that really covers for is the fact that we're prioritizing our own communities at the expense of other communities without really dealing with it. The problem on the other side is the risk of sort of closed-mindedness and parochialism, and the ways in which it can lead to sort of happens. It does not happen in a lot of ways in the Puerto Rican community that I work in, but I think there are ways in which it does happen, and I think that in the final analysis, a nationalist outlook says we have to prioritize the nation or the community over and against whatever other communities or nations are out there. And I think that that's the bedrock danger of that. And the last thing that I wanted to bring in is that in recent months, I guess, a lot of people in Chicago and elsewhere have been talking increasingly about third positionist fascism, and especially a couple of variants of that are this thing called national anarchism. And it throws a whole new monkey wrench into the mix, because national anarchism, as I understand it, is an approach that attempts to synthesize sort of the worst elements of nationalism and the worst elements of anarchism. But it's a number of the people who are attached to that outlook are very slick and articulate about putting forward this position that seems kind of enticing in some ways and is difficult in some ways to dispute. And I think that it's the emergence of those positions and my increasing awareness of them that has pushed me so slowly but surely, I think, towards a more anti-nationalist position. So I think that's about all that I wanted to say.
Great. Thank you, Mike. We're going to give Cindy a chance to formulate a couple of questions for Shanti and Mike.
I think these sort of relate to what both you said, but they're also maybe separate as well. For me, I was trying to understand how does nationalism relate to the values that people that consider themselves anarchists whole, so how do the principles of anarchism try to manifest, and Mike both for totally opening up my own narrow perspective about nationalism and really challenging my own thinking as an anarchist, especially with Shanti's with kind of a blanket rejection and understanding the subtleties. And I don't have, again, I think it's nice to maintain the subtleties because I don't think that you can find a hard and fast line between the two. But for me, it raises, for the values that it raises that I understand nationalism to be important to relate to anarchism is our understanding of a prefigurative politics. And that helps me understand that nationalism is as part of a prefigurative politics to get to the place as anarchists we talk about getting to, but that it is part of the prefigurative, not something we can necessarily reject along the path of getting to where we hope to get. But it's also essential to have some relationship and support of certain nationalism out of a sense of solidarity, which I think is another value in anarchism. And the third thing that I found helpful in understanding how anarchism and nationalism could relate is a sense of doing actually tangible anti-racist work that has some value in being bridged between nationalist struggles and anarchism is the anti-racist work. But the three sort of questions I want to raise, politics as it relates to anarchism, but raises troubling questions for me is what I wanted to look at. One was, I think that it raises the question of is context of where we are today, but I don't think it's sufficient. And there's a fantastic essay by a guy named, and I'm going to mispronounce his name because I don't speak French, I don't know how to pronounce it correctly. He was born Jewish, but never, ever, ever thought of himself as Jewish. I don't even know if he even knew he was Jewish. It was just his mother was Jewish. He's a French person. And then when the Holocaust came along, he could not be Jewish anymore, and he was actually tortured and put into a concentration camp and became a survivor, and as a philosopher, he said, actually he killed himself somewhere. But he wrote The Possibility of Being a Jew, and he talked about how, I don't identify as a Jew, I never did, but in a world that's anti-Semitic, I'm forced to, that isn't my people at the same time. And it was a fantastic essay in looking at the nuances of what does it mean to have a sense of people and community as people that lumps people together, whether you want to be lumped together, identifies you as a Jew, as a Black, et cetera, which you may want to take on as yourself too. For me, that emphasized the point that it's necessary in a world that still thinks in racial categories and isms that people need a sense of identity as a people and as a sense of liberation, both simultaneously. There's another book I want to project I've been reading by a guy named Paul Gilroy, who's a person of color, who wrote a book called Against Race. And he said we have to transcend racial thinking because it's always led to a sense of the other as problematic, as needing to be expelled or killed or eradicated. But at the same time, we live in a racist society and we can't ignore the question of those senses. We live in a racist world, but yet perhaps we don't want to think of people as these essentialist identities. So how can we balance liberation in the present and the necessity of people needing a sense of people with our longer goal of freedom as anarchists? The second, that was one question, is how does liberation and freedom relate to each other? The second thing that's troubling for me about nationalism is sort of, I love freedom of nation being basically natal or mesa, to be born, that there's something about nationalism that always has to come up with something that defines what the hell that nation is, regardless of whether it's a state. It has to have a boundedness. And I think as anarchists, I think we tend to want to break boundaries. The No Borders campaign, we want to expand on what the world looks like, not limit our identity, not come up with one essential identity. I'm always a woman, or I'm always a white woman, or I'm always a white woman who's an anarchist. But I can be an anarchist, a person who likes to swim, a person who likes to travel, someone who's a lover, a sister, et cetera, et cetera. That my identity has to broaden beyond one community. And I think anarchists have been really good about talking about, you know, communities of communities of communities. And I'm not sure you could talk about nationalisms, because they want to retain a sense of boundedness, which again is important in a world that bound you whether you want to be or not when you have racism. So how do we balance the boundedness of nationalism with the expansiveness that anarchism tries to look at? Especially important in a world where there's been a lot of great work with like transgender, for instance, with the multiplicity of identities and multiculturalisms and academics like to use the word hybridity, where there's a sense of mixing. But that's beautiful, I think, that we can have these multiple identities. So how do we relate anarchism expansiveness to the sense of boundedness? And the last thing I want to look at is if we have a sense of boundedness, of identity, capitalism is more and more, better and better at taking those identities and selling them. As anarchists, we see the products that we think of as anarchists become more and more hot commodities. And again, I'll point to this Paul Gilroy book. He does a fantastic job of looking at how blackness has become a commodity. You know, rap music is like sells all around the world to people that perhaps have never even met a person of color. Or that any identity can become something to sell and become a commodity. So how does nationalism and anarchism relate to commodification and capitalism? How does us needing to maintain our identities relate to a world that wants those identities to be able to be sold? And I worry, especially with national struggles, that they, because they bound themselves so tightly to identity, maybe hold themselves more open to being commodified, perhaps not, but as something to sell as an identity.
Thank you. The question that I just want to ask one sort of concrete question, I think mostly for Ashanti, although I'd also like to hear your response from working with your Puerto Rican comrades, who, as I understand things, sort of see themselves as living in the Puerto Rican diaspora here up in the States and not, right now at least, not in that, at this point in their life, on the island. But also mostly for Ashanti, from living in New York City, such a mosaic of totally different communities right next to each other. How is it that you see yourself having something rather in common with various of your comrades? What are the things that create that kind of shared identity when you meet another African-American person in New York City versus when you work with mostly white anarchists? Or for that matter, what are even the points of commonality between Haitians in New York City, West Africans in New York City, people who've been here for the past, you know, 12 generations and so on and so forth, and how do you negotiate those? I've got political shared things, sort of shared perspectives, and then I've got identity shared things. What, for both of you, what brings those things together in your real-world experience?
I can respond to some of the questions that Cindy raised around identity. You know, like, I mean, people know we came here, you know, as a result of being kidnapped from Africa, and we found ourselves here. The experience being here kind of shaped and molded us into who we now call African-American people, people of African descent, black people, new Africans, so forth and so on, and there's other identifications that we use. For those of us who have a history here, you know, who've been here for a long while, you know, just to use a common, you know, African-American, it's not only a history here, but we have, we play a certain role in terms of existence, where we have a history. Since the moment we landed on these shores, we've been resisting in all kind of ways. I think in the last 30, 40 years, we've seen other people of color come into, like say New York, for example. New York, New Jersey, because I'm basically from New Jersey. People of different nationalities of color. For them, black is not so much the ethnic group, but it's black as a symbol of resistance, a symbol of opposition, and people find that in our culture, and in this sense, I'm talking about black culture in particular, ways to resist, ways to kind of maintain their own identity from where they come from. Like, for example, in New York City, a lot of South Asians and Indians identify as black. And they're not talking about as African Americans, but there's something, you know, about, you know, how our culture is situated and how our people live our lives that allows them to express who they are and their ways of fighting back. And I found out it's the same in, to a great extent in England, you know. So it's like there's this identity that is related to specific histories, but then there's this identity that becomes a symbol, you know, of resistance. But in that, even with ours, if I just deal with African Americans, I mean, it's like we've been through changes, you know. I mean, we wasn't always African Americans, you know. And I mean, at first, I mean, and still today, that term nigger is still there, you know, but that was the first term that people called us after they had stopped us from being able to practice, you know, whatever the indigenous culture that we were from and what is called Africa, You know, and once we took on this language and we couldn't practice our own, and Christianity became the language, and the ways of our so-called masters became our ways, you know, but we still had to find ways within there to fight back. So Christianity became our religion, but it became a kind of resistance Christianity. It wasn't just Christianity the way that the slave master thought of, you know, as Harriet Tubman, all of them showed. And we took other things from this culture to survive, to help us survive in terms of a people, to help us survive just in terms of saving our lives. And sometimes that was a process that we call putting on old masks. Sometimes it's not just direct maternal fighting. Sometimes it's like being slick and sophisticated in the ways that we fight back. But people, other people who come into contact with us, you know, find that aspect of our lives as an inspiration to them when they come here. The openness of it is that we change. You know, as we struggle, we change. So black is having become solidified. You know, like we struggle, we have spaces where we dialogue, and we have other conditions that force us to break boundaries, our own boundaries. Even like right now, I mean, you got the black queer community, black queer activists who are not allowing the nationalist definitions of black to be the only definition. You know, that has to change. You know, so even within there, you know, it's not like solidified in one way, that there's that element of change within it. So in that sense, you know, we, even in our nationalistic struggles, there's that expansiveness. We move, we change according to the circumstances. And I think that's very important to understand, is that we're not just one people. We've just been identified one way. Within our identity, we are always changing. You know, we have to change. And, you know, Fanon talks about that. You know, like when we move, when we live, when we travel, we have to change. You know, it's just part of survival. It's part of trying to reach, you know, some goal of liberation. We have to change.
I think one thing that Ashanti said clicked really well with me, talking about South Asians in New York or in England identifying themselves as black. There is an awful lot of that happens at a very, among young Puerto Ricans in Chicago. And that is sort of overwhelmingly visible at the high school that I work at, you know, talking with 14, 15, 16-year-old Puerto Rican kids whose cultural identity is this interesting mix of sort of like mostly African American hip hop identity and then like salsa and, you know, like Puerto Rican cultural heritage identity that you don't find if you go to Puerto Rico. You find it in a different context in Puerto Rico. But it fits really well with the tradition inside Puerto Rican sort of self-understanding, this thing called the three roots. And the three roots are the European heritage, the indigenous heritage, and the African heritage. And it's a common way, especially for Puerto Rican radicals, to understand their cultural heritage as Puerto Ricans. What makes Puerto Ricans a distinct national identity is the particular combination of those three cultural backgrounds. And I guess in response to one of Sibby's comments about the question of whether nationalism builds boundaries and anarchism breaks them down, I think there is a level on which that's a helpful schematic for me. But there are a lot of ways in which it's just not true for particular forms of nationalism, and in particular, the forms of Puerto Rican nationalism with which I am most familiar are primarily aimed at this sort of forward-looking inclusion of various cultural backgrounds. They're not, there's no attempt to mythologize, you know, some sort of like made-up history of Puerto Rican identity. There are other strains of Puerto Rican nationalism that are somewhat less in favor now than they were maybe 50 years ago, that were more or less like Kennethists. There was a branch of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party in the 30s and 40s that was pro-Franco. They identified themselves as being Spanish and said that, you know, the future Puerto Rican nation would be run by people of Spanish descent. But that has really been supplanted in the last 40, 50 years, largely, not just entirely, but largely been replaced by this notion of the three roots and the celebration of the multiple heritages that that come together to make up Puerto Rican identity. I guess that's about it. I really like Cindy's comment about the way in which capitalism is able to sort of commodify or recuperate in one way or another all these different sorts of expressions, whether they're cultural expressions or economic ones. And I know that's something that that a lot of the community struggle with, and it happens that it's also something that that I see and that disappoints me about working with the Puerto Rican community as years go on, that there's a level in which that's actively embraced by a lot of all of what used to be more revolutionary nationalists. But I don't have a good solution. How do I overcome that? Okay.